From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In the months since September 11th, America's popularity in the foreign press has largely tracked with the successes and failures of its war on terrorism. Editorialists have variously praised U.S. leadership, questioned its capacities, castigated its hegemony, and called for its intervention. However, since President Bush's State of the Union address, with his memorable locution, Axis of Evil, grouping Iraq with Iran and North Korea, the world press has jointly recoiled. The reverberations continued this week, compounded by other news. UPI senior correspondent Martin Walker reads us through Europe and Asia.
Spain's El Mundo, a centrist, even slightly conservative paper, I quote, "The Western alliance forged after September the 11th has begun to crack. The origin of the breach isn't in Europe, whose solidarity with the United States and willingness to combat terrorism remains strong, but with the foreign policy of the American government, determined unilaterally to pursue its private war against evil, without worrying too much about the cost for international peace."
What is it about that axis that strikes these editorialists as not sufficiently evil to be worried about?
I think most editorialists accept that there is something particularly shocking and unpleasant about Iraq itself and about the regime of Saddam Hussein. What they do seem to ask is, what exactly is it? And this is a question that was raised in the very conservative and pro-American British Telegraph. What exactly is it that President Bush is trying to achieve? Is he trying to rally world opinion? He's failed. Is he trying to strengthen his coalition against three palpably wicked powers? Again, he appears to have failed. It's rather difficult to understand exactly what it is that Mr. Bush wants to achieve with his rhetoric, except for some kind of moral distinction between the United States and those deemed its enemies.
What did the South Korean press have to say about the axis of evil?
Well, bear in mind that President Bush is about to visit South Korea, and this is the pro-government Hankyore Shinmun in an editorial. "The Bush doctrine of the axis of evil only serves the interest of Bush and the Americans and poses a terrible threat to world peace, especially peace on the peninsula. The U.S. must halt its unilateral and militaristic moves, undermining efforts for peace by North and South Korea, for we are the owners of the Korean peninsula, not the Americans." The centrist Jung Ang Ilbo said that Mr. Bush is excessively self-righteous and aggressive, all the more so, given that North Korea leaves open the possibility of resuming bilateral talks with the Americans. "The American government must end its impetuous approach to inter-Korean reconciliation." I was also struck by something from Vietnam. This is from Hanoi Mui, which is one of the official paper of the Vietnam government. "While hunting for terrorism, Washington is paying no attention to eradicating the socio-economic causes of terrorism, as well as the causes of the extremist attitudes towards the West in general and against the U.S. in particular. The strong-arm tactics of Washington's global policy will only result in forces of resistance from others."
So in many papers, America's moral leadership continues to erode. I gather that hasn't been helped by the big financial story either, has it?
Well, that's absolutely right. One of the very striking features, I think, of recent days has been the way in which commentators around the world have been bringing in the Enron scandal as a way of targeting America's own sense of moral leadership here. In Le Figaro, a very conservative Paris newspaper, "It is sad that the old continent is lagging in economic growth, and even sadder that it is incapable of proposing an alternative to the American system of market economy, while the Enron scandal so highlights its successes and its failures." Now here from Saudi Arabia is a very moderate Arab news. "Multinationals need to have checks upon them, just as do global superpowers, controls that superpower governments often are reluctant to exercise. But if a mammoth company like Enron is prepared to bribe and cheat within the establishment, perhaps we need the yelling anti-capitalist outsiders to keep on crying foul, even if they're wrong some of the time, just as America, in its own best interests, needs friendly critics of a sometimes wayward foreign policy."
Martin, thank you very much, as always.
Thank you.
Martin Walker is the chief correspondent for United Press International. He joins us for the 11,000th time, and a delight as always. ¶¶
London's Guardian newspaper recently observed that BBC bureaucrats aren't the obvious candidates to help rebuild Afghanistan. But a BBC team did travel there recently to assess its media needs and found to its surprise that media was at the top of many Afghans' lists, along with shelter and food. When the team brought its findings to a conference in Japan recently, the major nations assembled there pledged $70 million to the cause of constructing a media infrastructure. The reason, according to BBC team leader John Tuckey, is that there can be no life without peace, and there can be no peace without media to unify the fractured nation.
There needs to be political communication within the country, and everybody we spoke to saw the media as the major tool for that communication.
How did the existing Afghan media fare under the Taliban? We've all heard about the ban on music. We have to assume there was a ban on the free exchange of information as well.
There never has been free exchange of information in Afghanistan, as far as I can understand it. Even before the Taliban ban on television, television did not, in fact, cover the whole country. It never has covered the whole country.
So then what sort of infrastructure is there to build upon?
There is quite a strong infrastructure of institutions. There's Radio and Television Afghanistan, there's BACTAR, the state news agency. In training terms, there's the Faculty of Journalism at the University of Kabul. So there is the institutional infrastructure there.
What did you recommend to the Tokyo conference?
We recommended a national broadcaster. We were aware that there are risks in doing that, but everybody felt that if you have, say, a model of community radio stations or local radio stations and build up a network from that, what you would actually get are factional stations controlled by warlords. So there was a very, very strong feeling that a national broadcaster, which could be multilingual and could act as this cultural and political tool for the reconstruction of the country, was an essential. Now, we are not naive. I mean, among the team, there was the BBC World Service's regional editor for Eurasia. And he pointed out that there is virtually no country in that region which has a free media. But the case for it was very strong. And everybody from the chairman of the interim authority, Hamid Karzai, down, said that the national broadcaster must have some kind of editorial independence. Hamid Karzai himself actually was in favour of a kind of BBC model where you have a sort of board of governors which put it at arm's length from the government.
You asked the question in your piece in The Guardian, can anyone really expect a strong independent media to emerge from a fractured warlord state with a traumatised and scattered population? But you came back with a measure of hope.
Oh, we certainly came back with a measure of hope. I mean, it's very often that quite radical things do come out of the immediate post-conflict situations. The BBC itself came out of the trauma for Britain of the First World War. There is a great sense of optimism. I mean, there's a great sense of fear. People are not complacent that all of this is going to work. But there is a lot of optimism. And our feeling was that when you've got so much momentum in a post-conflict situation, it really is the time to take that chance.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
John Tuckey was the team leader of the needs assessment team that the BBC sent to Afghanistan on behalf of the United Nations.
We are not going to compare the priorities of the BBC and American TV news, but Carla Garapetian probably could. She is an American and a former newscaster for the BBC. Now she is a producer for Britain's commercial Channel 4, but in a recent Los Angeles Times article, Garapetian was effusive with praise for her former employer, mainly because the BBC, she wrote, made no attempt to poof her up like a talking Barbie doll. Carla Garapetian joins us now from Los Angeles. Carla, welcome to OTM.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, you're sitting in Los Angeles. I'm in Washington. I can't see you, but I presume you have an eye tuck.
If I had an eye tuck at the BBC, I think I would have been hung and quartered. What they're concerned about is more how you pronounce words and foreign countries and foreign names. They want you to be cool. They want you to have a certain amount of gravitas, because what is being sold at the BBC is not the anchors, but the BBC as a news organization. The branding is in the BBC.
And from a cosmetic point of view, I gather from your piece that the BBC is a lot less hairstyle intensive than NBC was.
I've described it as becoming a senior citizen overnight. I found myself oftentimes sitting in shadow, not having a makeup artist coming over and powdering my nose. So I found that a little difficult, but I got used to it.
Now, there is some irony in that your glowing article in the LA Times about the BBC last week comes at a time when in the United Kingdom there is an increasing amount of criticism towards the BBC for precisely dumbing down the news and for reacting to market forces. Have you detected any change in the way the BBC is doing things? Are they getting more like American networks rather than less?
I think in terms of their entertainment division, they are becoming more American. I think with regard to the news, news is sacrosanct there, and it is not yet succumbing to the American influence. And by that, I mean treating news as entertainment.
There's been grumbling from veteran female BBC correspondents like Kate Ady, who say that all of a sudden Auntie Beeb is hiring pretty faces to the exclusion of not-so-pretty ones.
I think that there probably is a pressure. I think it's more for the presenters, the on-air anchors, and I don't think that they are applying those, what I would say, dumbing down their standards with regard to the correspondents. But to the people on air, I've noticed
that they are...
So they
have a really ugly batch of correspondents. Is that what you're telling me?
No.
You're telling me they're absolutely heinous, aren't you? You're saying...
I'm saying that the people in the field are the real people who are really down and dirty, and they're doing their job. And when once you put somebody in the studio, there is the inclination to gloss them up. But I'll tell you, I very much doubt that it will go towards the Pamela Anderson look. I think it's going to stay very much with the Miss Moneypenny look.
Carla Garapedian, thank you very much.
Thank you. I enjoyed talking to you, Bob.
Carla Garapedian is a documentary producer for England's Channel 4 and a former news presenter for BBC World.
Coming up, the cost of covering Kosovo, 6 years of Slate, and viral marketing. You may already be infected.
Ew. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The online magazine Slate made its debut in June of 1996. It was Microsoft's entry into the field of zines and might have been a big story anyway, but the real reason people paid attention was because of the man Bill Gates put in charge, Michael Kinsley, a liberal intellectual of highest regard whose sharp observations graced the pages of Time, The Washington Post, and The New Republic, whose nasal witticisms resounded on Crossfire. That was a great get for Gates. But Kinsley is stepping down as editor of Slate after more than 6 years. That's about 35 in web years, isn't it, Michael?
At least.
The editors of two zines, Suck.com and Feed.com, both said when you started that you wouldn't be innovating, you would just be reinventing the wheel.
We were trying to do the equivalent of print journalism on the web in the sense that we wanted it to be respectable and we wanted it to have the integrity and accuracy of print. But I think we did innovate in many ways. in trying to figure out ways to use the technology to serve journalism and basically to compensate people for the fact that they have to sit and read it on a computer screen. In fact, that problem is one we have never solved, specifically the problem of publishing long New Yorker Atlantic-type pieces on the web. And it just may well be that that's a type of journalism that is not suitable to the web.
We'll talk about that. How do you get big ideas in shorter packages?
Well, the thing we've done most successfully, I think, is adapt the voice of email, which is really a new medium and is one that many people find extremely good for discussing ideas because it has the spontaneity of talking with the reflectiveness of writing. And we have dialogues, we have diaries, we have dispatches. We even do our book reviews that way.
What about the audio-video aspect of the net? Was it everything it was cracked up to be? I remember in your first issue of Slate, you had Fats Waller singing, you had Seamus Heaney
reading some poetry.
Yeah, you
made fun of us for that on NPR, Brooke.
I made fun of Seamus Heaney maybe a little.
Yeah, Fats Waller is sacred, but Seamus Heaney's fair game, right? One of the things we have failed to do, and everyone else has failed too, is use multimedia in ways that are more than just a gimmick. And cultural criticism, I think, is the best opportunity. But we haven't developed critics and a critical voice where people use the clips the way you use quotes in a book review, really as an integrated part of your argument. If you think about it, a music review spends huge numbers of words in the basically impossible task of trying to describe music in words, and then the writer makes his or her point. On the internet, you don't have to describe the music. You can quote it.
You have said that one of your goals was to make Slate self-sufficient. It's done really well. It has more than 2 million unique users in a month, according to Media Metrics.
2.8 million in January. Just got the numbers the other day.
But you haven't made it break even yet. And I think you've described yourself as kind of Moses leading them across the desert but never quite making it to the promised land.
Well, first of all, I'm sorry I said that about Moses. I think we will get there slightly slower than I expected.
Now, Slate made the bold experiment of charging for subscriptions, and after years of trying, you never really penetrated enough to make that viable. And so now you've gone back to the ad model. Do you think it's the ad model that ultimately will work for online journalism?
Yes, I think the ad model is the most promising one for us. We had 30,000 subscribers, which was not terrible at the end of the first year. But meanwhile, we had a front porch, as we called it, a free space, that was getting 400,000 subscribers. And now, of course, we have 2, 3, 4 million visitors, not subscribers. So it seemed to us that selling ads that would be seen by millions of people was a more likely route to a self-sustaining financial situation.
So why are you stepping down?
I was starting to get a little stale, I felt, so I thought for myself and for Slate it's time to let someone else do it. And also, I have Parkinson's, and that was a small factor. I'm certainly capable of doing this job or any other one I want, but it'll be nice to have more time to exercise and lead a more regular life, which helps control the symptoms.
Colleagues have been saying in the papers that no one would be able to tell that you had Parkinson's since, I guess, 93, the hiking, the winter sports. You've said in the papers that it's not so much health that you're worried about as time.
I don't think it's quite true that you can't tell. But most of the time, it's hard to tell, certainly, and it doesn't really impact my life very much. And I want to use the time to do things which I can certainly do now, but I might not be able to do in future years.
Thanks a lot, Michael.
Hey, thank you, Brooke.
Michael Kinsley is the former editor of Slate.com.
There was a time when the 30-second TV spot could really move the dial for consumers. In marketing speak, that means make people buy things. But any ad man will tell you that the cost to make a TV spot is going up, all the while the number of people buying things based on TV spots seems to be going down. In the media-saturated 21st century, print, radio, even TV may be losing their power to sell. So, what's a marketer to do? Forget the media. OTM's Jad Abumrad takes a look at viral marketing, where the message is spread mouth to mouth.
The following is a dramatization. You're at your local dive, and you've managed to get a seat at the bar. Score. Things get better. An attractive woman taps you on the shoulder, hands you $5, and asks you to order her a drink.
Excuse me. Hi. Could you order me a veggie water with vodka?
Suddenly, the beer you're drinking seems so average.
Huh? What kind of drink is that?
I'll tell you a little secret. Veggie water makes a great cocktail mixer.
The two of you chat for a while. Nothing comes of this interaction, but you're feeling good about yourself, so the next day, you tell a friend about the attractive woman who bought this obscure drink. He asks what kind of drink, you tell him. He tells his mom, who tells her yoga instructor, and soon they're all trying it.
The exponential power of word of mouth is phenomenal.
This is just the sort of scenario that Jonathan Ressler specializes in. He's the CEO of Big Fat Promo Incorporated. Oh, I forgot to tell you, that attractive woman in real life is actually paid to be what Ressler calls a leaner.
They're aspirational but approachable, so they're not supermodels. They're just kind of people that look like they fit.
Leaners get their name because they're hired by companies like Big Fat to literally lean over the people sitting at the bar and strike up a conversation about a product. The goal, according to Jonathan, is to circumvent their traditional media ad glut and get the product in front of people when their advertising force field is down. Next step, turn those unsuspecting targets into unknowing evangelists for your product. And it doesn't just happen in bars.
You might come home and see a whole bunch of boxes from some online and catalog retailer sitting by the podium where your doorman is. You subconsciously think, boy, a lot of people are ordering from X.com. Now, you don't know that they're empty boxes that we paid the doorman to keep there.
A successful campaign produces that mystical substance, buzz. Something which, 10, 15 years ago, was thought to happen naturally, unexpectedly. Now, it's carefully orchestrated through a series of usually covert product placements. But sometimes companies can't help themselves and brag about their in-person promotions. Vespa, for instance, revealed a campaign where they sent beautiful people to bars on scooters, with the mission of getting as many phone numbers as possible. The next day, the beautiful people never called, but a Vespa dealer did. Needless to say, some people in the ad world are not pleased with this type of trickery. Ad commentator Kate Kay is one. She outlined her complaints in the 35-page missive, Sales Pitch Society.
The idea of people becoming essentially media buys on the same level as a billboard or a television spot in the mind of the advertiser is really upsetting.
Herein lies the debate. Does this type of in-person, often surreptitious advertising compromise personal relationships? Or does it actually give consumers a fighting chance?
I feel like it empowers the consumer. I do.
Amanda Kekkonen is the marketing and promotions director at a nightclub called Spa.
It gives the consumer an opportunity to push back.
Push back how?
Push back, like, ask questions.
But who knows to ask questions? Maybe people just want to have a quiet beer at the end of the day. And it's those type of moments that are being stolen from them. Shouldn't consumers be allowed to have a place where they won't be pitched?
It presupposes, actually, that we did have that place before, and we've lost it, and I don't know that our society was ever free from marketing in one form or another. Farmers used to paint advertisements on their hogs. Patent medicine companies would buy that space.
I guess that tells you that marketing is very adaptable. You can trace the modern roots of in-person promotion to Edward Bernays, the father of advertising. In the 1930s, at a time when it wasn't kosher for women to smoke in public, Bernays sent 1,000 debutante women to an Easter parade smoking Lucky Strikes.
And that one act in the press that was covered after that sort of changed America's smoking habits.
Sam Ewan, a Bernays admirer, is CEO of Interference Incorporated, an alternative marketing firm in New York City. He says that the new interest in so-called viral marketing is partly due to Generation Y. According to a study by the marketing research group ESOMAR, Generation Y is an ad man's paradox. While they're increasingly resistant to traditional TV ads, ironically, they don't mind being commercials themselves.
It used to be sort of a stigma to be a sellout. These days, when you look at commercials, the goal is to sell out.
Take Chris and Luke, the first college students in America to have their tuition sponsored by selling themselves as walking billboards for a major corporation. They spent a year looking for a buyer.
Luke and I had, like, we first made our announcement, and then, like, right off the bat, we did about 300 radio interviews searching for a sponsor.
This is Chris. Luke couldn't make it because of chemistry class. The two high school buddies eventually settled on First USA.
I have to say, myself, I don't know whether to be impressed or disturbed. And do you get that reaction a lot?
Not too often. The most people who get disturbed think we're just getting like $40,000 for free and we're not doing anything.
In the case of Chris and Luke, the brand message is overt. They lecture at college campuses, spend 12-hour Saturdays doing radio interviews. They're just like celebrity spokespeople, only they're not celebrities. But Jonathan Ressler of Big Fat prefers his in-person advertisers to be undercover. The object is to slip in, plant the message, and slip out without arousing the slightest suspicion.
And by the way, it is everywhere. There's a lot of people doing it.
Really? Yeah. So this is more common than we realize.
For it to be effective, you never know what happened. So you don't know. I could be doing it to you right now. I could be.
Come to think of it, maybe he was. With ad budgets shrinking and TV commercial phobes turning to technology like TiVo for relief, what's left for the agencies to do except get reporters like me to do the heavy lifting for them? For On the Media, and God knows who else, this is Jad Abumrad.
If bar leaning is the marketing technique of the future, we wonder if it has caught the attention of CMG Worldwide, the Indianapolis-based licensing firm. CMG has just been entrusted by the estate of Mahatma Gandhi to protect and market his image. Mahatma Gandhi moved an entire nation into peaceful revolution. The question is, can he move merchandise?
Pardon me, young woman. I would be most honored if you would permit me to lean across you in order to reach my non-alcoholic cocktail.
No problem. Oh!
I'm sorry. I appear to have spilled my Rajmataj on your dress.
Rajmataj?
Yes, a delightful and surprising concoction of Darjeeling tea and Yoohoo brand chocolate-flavored drink. I find it to be indelicious. May I say you have supple skin?
Hey, Courtney, is this skinny dude bothering you? Hey, buddy, don't make me teach you a lesson.
You can torture me, you can beat me, but you can't beat the flavor of a Rajmataj cocktail.
The trial of Slobodan Milosevic opened this week in The Hague. The former Serbian strongman stands charged with atrocities committed in Kosovo in the 1999 war. A lot of what we now know about these events we learned from reporters who defied the media ban imposed by the Milosevic government. Matthew McAllister was reporting for Newsday when he made three treacherous journeys over the mountains that separate Montenegro and Kosovo during the winter of 1999. Along the way, he was aided by ethnic Albanians. McAllister, in his book Beyond the Mountains of the Damned, writes of lives lost in the service of his reporting, and he weighs the costs.
We had hired two Albanian guides who, when we returned 3 days later, had not come back. And for them, that was an easy walk. It was like a two-hour stroll through the woods. It was very tough for us because we were not fit and healthy Albanian men. And they just didn't make it back. And for weeks, you know, I was extremely worried and wanted to know what had happened to them. And what had happened to them, as I found out at the end of the war, was that they had, in fact, been caught by Serbian soldiers. They were captured and held for a week, and one of them was very, very badly beaten, so much so that his torso was blackened with the bruising.
Beaten because they were cooperating with the Western press, beaten because they were Albanians in the wrong place at the wrong time. I mean, how much responsibility did you believe personally that you bore on this?
They were beaten because they were cooperating with the Western press, and they wouldn't have been beaten otherwise. I mean, they may have. I mean, they may have been killed just because they are Albanians. But in this case, I happen to know that they did, during interrogation, explain who we were, and so the Serbs apparently went looking for us. So, yeah, I think there was a degree of responsibility, and you're right, as you said in the beginning, it makes me a little uneasy to this day.
How do you deal with it?
I deal with it the same way that I would deal with it in terms of my, I think, my own entry into a dangerous situation, and that is the story worth it? Was the story worth it? I felt that, really, as a journalist, it was my responsibility to tell this story, which seemed to me a very clear moral tale in many respects. And in order to do that, the stakes had to be upped a little bit. And during that trip, I did witness Serbian paramilitaries burning houses, and we took photographs of this. I don't think that had been seen before in the Western press. And so, you know, it was something that on a Sunday morning, the reader 5 or 6 weeks into the war would say, oh, you know, well, so it is true. And this is what happens, and this is what it looks like. You know, we should pay attention to this instead of just tuning out. One could argue that that's not justification for getting someone else into the kind of trouble that these two men got into, but, well...
Is there some magic rule for determining what to write, what not to write, and how do you determine the threshold of it is now time to put innocent lives at risk for the sake of the story?
There's no magic rule. The job is to go there and tell a story and to explain to the world what's going on. It's not to endanger people's lives. If you come across information as a reporter, you're always sort of ferreting things out, and you come across information that, if published, is going to endanger someone's life, but at the same time enhances the reporting, you just have to make it up and make that decision. And but I can't tell you what the rule is and what the threshold is, because you have to weigh every situation up when it comes.
Very well. Matthew McAllister, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Matthew McAllister is a Middle East correspondent for Newsday and author of Beyond the Mountains of the Damned.
Coming up, confusion in Antarctica, Condit courts the media, and what it means when the mime shows up.
It means I walk out. This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The finding, published in the prestigious peer-reviewed journal Nature, was provocative. Climactic changes in Antarctica were resulting in cooling conditions on certain parts of that continent. But the press saw something more intriguing still, what seemed to be juicy evidence against the prevailing theories on global warming. And so, ignoring all the researchers who said otherwise, much of the media reported exactly that. Joining us now to discuss how they got it wrong is Peter Doran, co-author of the Antarctica Study. He says his finding does not in any way hurt the case for global warming.
If you look at the warming trends that have been published recently, just this past year by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is really the Bible of climate change, you can see that the majority of the globe is warming. There is really no doubt about that. What we did is we just went in and teased out what's going on spatially in Antarctica and showed that most of the continent is cooling.
So your study appeared in Nature magazine. And then you got to sit back and watch journalism take place. What were the results?
There were some cases of glorification or sensationalization of the results, especially in the headlines. And if I could read you a few examples, I've got some in front of me. There's one here that says, guess what? Antarctica's getting colder, not warmer. New data may affect political debate over global warming. Some other headlines, scientific findings run counter to theory of global warming. Oh dear, what will the doomsayers say now?
CNN ran a story in which the lead anchor began the piece by saying, quote, a new study is casting doubt on the widely accepted theory of global warming. Now, the strange thing about that CNN piece is they quoted you and another scientist saying, well, no, this really doesn't in any way discredit the conventional wisdom on global warming. And yet all of the body copy, the reporter's copy in the piece, sent out an opposite message. When you see something like that, what do you do? How do you react?
I get frustrated. You know, it's all about sound bites. They get these little sound bites, and then they talk over you and put together the sound bites in the way they want to, much as you will probably do with this today, but I trust you, Bob.
well, that's it. There's mistake number one. What do you think the problem is with how your study in particular and how science in general is reported by the media?
I think it's time. Time and deadlines are the big thing. I've noticed that a lot of the biggest errors were in the print stories that came out the very next day from the press release, and there seems to be this rush to get the story out first, which is common in the media, and it's understandable for most things, but it doesn't seem to work with science. As we write these peer-reviewed papers, we're very careful with every single word in that paper. We choose carefully whether we can use an adverb or not in a particular location, and then that paper gets submitted to a journal like Nature or Science, and those papers get sent out for peer review. And then once it's accepted by Science or Nature or some other journal, it goes to press. Then the press release comes. It gets written usually with the scientist's input, but there's no peer review there. Then the press release goes out, and the press grab it, and they start writing a story based on the press release, but they add their own little touch to the story, and that's what reporters do. That's understandable. But at each step of the way, there's some of the accuracy lost. There's some of the control lost.
So you're describing whisper down the lane or telephone or the party game in which the information keeps getting degraded at each step along the way.
Exactly. And then the last step is when, for instance, talk show hosts will pick up the stories from the news items and treat it like it's absolute fact. And so you get this broken telephone that goes all the way down to the public, and then the public believes it.
What can reporters do to be more certain that they're getting it right or getting it at least close to right?
If there's enough time, send the story back to the scientist, not to suggest changes in phrasing or whatever, but just to make sure that you got it right.
Well, we've decided on a title for this segment. I guess I, under the circumstances, ought to run it by you. Tell me what you think. Scientist says the media are pure evil. That work for you?
The axis of evil. Maybe the axis of not so evil.
Well, we'll see what we can do. We have, you know, we have deadline pressures. Peter Dorn, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Bob.
Peter Dorn is a professor at the University of Illinois at Chicago and the lead author of one Antarctica study that appeared last month in the journal Nature. Gary Condit. You may remember him as co-sponsor of House Resolution 134 that supported National Civility Week in its efforts to restore civility, honesty, integrity, and respectful consideration in the United States. Or you may know him from the case of the still-missing intern, Chandra Levy. Either way, if you're a voter in his district, he wants you to get to know him once more. And to that end, he's campaigning in Modesto, California. He recently invited Frank Bruni of the New York Times Magazine to tag along to get a taste of that old Condit magic. Frank, welcome to OTM.
Thanks for having me.
If Gary Condit is trying to win the vote in his district and he believes he's the victim of the national media, why in the world would he invite the New York Times to ride along with him?
I think he invited us, in a sense, to show that he has nothing to hide or to assert that he has nothing to hide. And the New York Times was one of the news organizations that did not pay an enormous amount of attention to the whole Chandra Levy scandal. And at this point, his poll numbers are pretty bad. His fundraising is no better. And I don't know what he has to lose.
Well, I know what he's got to lose. I've read the piece, and it portrays a man very nearly pitiful in his denial, surrounded by family members with what looks to me like a kind of sympathetic sense of denial and paranoia. I don't know if that's the way you read your own piece.
What I encountered as I talked to him and spent several hours with him was a guy who's become so convinced of his own victimization that he seems to have lost sight of his hand in it.
Yeah, you said in your piece, in his heart he knows he's right. The key word to me in that is knows. Does he genuinely believe that he has done nothing to warrant the excessive scrutiny that he's received?
He believes that the one thing that is, let's say, a fact not in dispute, which is the affair with Chandra Levy, is his own business, not something that has any implications on his public service. And since he has told himself and convinced himself of that much, he then proceeds to the fact that many pundits, especially on you know, cable news stations, basically convicted him of foul play in the disappearance of Levy with no hard evidence and no charges from the police, and he focuses solely on that. And if you only look at that, you can see why he feels aggrieved.
There is a moment where you say that the congressman implies that the Levy family owes him a debt of gratitude for keeping their daughter's name in the news. What was that moment like?
I asked him if before he decided to run again, if he had thought about the impact that might have on the Levies. And what he said to me, which was quite surprising because it was so indelicate and it was a peek into his own sense of persecution, I think, he said that they should be happy he's running again because if he does not remain in Congress and stops being a figure in the news, you won't hear much about Chandra anymore and the case and the cause to find her will disappear.
Was there any reaction to what you've written from his camp? Are they going to think they got hosed?
I don't know. People read things in a lot of different ways. The piece makes very clear that Gary has been an extraordinarily good congressman for his district. The piece takes note of what an intelligent and authoritative lawmaker he can be. And in that sense, I think they'll look at it and say, well, that's fair, in the sense that it portrays a guy who seems to be in the grip of a strange kind of defiance that some people might even find to be delusion. Well, maybe they won't like that, but it's a very accurate portrayal of what I encountered.
Well, Frank Bruni, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Frank Bruni writes for the New York Times Magazine. His article, Gary Condit is Still Running, is in this week's issue. And now your letters and a few updates. A few weeks ago, we considered the case of Grigory Pasko, a Russian military journalist. In 1997, he was arrested for allegedly giving a Japanese reporter classified information about Russia's dumping of nuclear waste into the Pacific. In December, he was sentenced to 4 years in prison for treason. This week, the case against him seemed to fall apart when, among other things, the court ruled that Pasko could not be held liable for violating an unpublished law.
Last week, I interviewed the two directors of the documentary Two Towns of Jasper, and several listeners wondered how they could see the film. Well, despite great notices at Sundance, the film has yet to find a distributor. It is scheduled to play at some film festivals across the country and will be broadcast on PBS this fall.
We got a big response to my talk with linguist and political essayist Noam Chomsky. Many, like Lenore Azaroff of Lowell, Massachusetts, objected to my referring to Chomsky as a human flamethrower for calling America a terrorist state. Far from inflaming, she writes, Dr. Chomsky presents rational, carefully worded approaches to even the most difficult and controversial topics.
We caught Chomsky just before he flew to Istanbul, where his Turkish publisher stood charged with terrorism for publishing his essays. An update this week, the Boston Globe reports that Chomsky was in the courtroom when the charges were dismissed. The prosecution decided that his description of Turkish efforts to eradicate the Kurds did not, in fact, constitute propaganda against the unity of Turkey.
On Brooke's interview with CBS producer Wayne Nelson about the impact of working in an office within sight of a continuous live shot of Ground Zero, Donnie Jean Stewart of Londonderry, New Hampshire, had this to say. I often freelance for a cable news operation that has the Ground Zero live shot tuned in. The site, especially at night, lit by huge construction fixtures, seems truly like a vision of a post-apocalyptic world. I watched that shot, unable to look away, in part so that I don't forget the horror, but also to seek some visible sense of recovery in the landscape of Ground Zero.
But many were offended by a phrase I used when I asked the CBS producer if he ever feels he just has to turn the camera off. Amy Allison writes, "Many people like me, believers in Jesus Christ, were insulted. Is taking the Lord's name in vain the only way to express the feelings of frustration you were trying to convey? I regret any offense I caused. We appreciate your letters. Keep them coming to onthemedia@wnyc.org, and please don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name." Video games usually are seen as a form of entertainment when they're not being assailed as breeding grounds for violence. But the most popular games are more like missives sent to players from game designers about the way they see the world. Games are filled with messages, some of them not subtle, like shoot or be shot, but a few actually convey broad philosophies of life. One video game plays upon what must have been the first human form of entertainment, watching other humans, and includes large chunks of philosophy and social science. Our producer-at-large Mike Pesca learned a little about the meaning of life, at least the simulated life, when he got into The Sims.
Search internet message boards long enough, and you'll find advice on every topic from aardvark husbandry to Zoloft. But it's still quite jarring to read a paragraph like this one. "Naturally born babies will take traits from the two parents. Adopted babies may or may not. Most buyable babies are light-skinned. Maybe some site has medium and dark-skinned buyable babies. I don't know." This raised such disturbing biological and religious issues that there was only one person to turn to: God. But God, who lives in the Bay Area and was kind enough to go to the studios of KQED in San Francisco, could only muster a shake of his omniscient head.
"The cause of a particular outcome can be so far buried in this chaotic mixture that even as the designer, you know, it's almost impossible for me to predict what it's all going to add up to."
At this juncture, a word of explanation is in order. The baby discussion referred to a simulated universe inside a computer game called The Sims, and the god of The Sims world is game designer Will Wright. In the game, a player controls a character called a Sim, imbuing him or her with personality traits like energy and kindness, and guiding the Sim through such life decisions as what kind of house to build and when to go to the bathroom. Wright is God because he created the entire Sim universe, which allows players to pull the strings of human interaction. Players can get their Sims jobs, marry them off, move them into bigger and bigger homes, or they can create self-defined utopias.
"I don't play a game that has a winning or not winning mode to it."
Lucy Chemnitzer is a devoted Sims player from Santa Cruz, California.
"I always play kind of a nice game. I prevent my Sims from getting into fights. If they get the urge to slap, I always make them stop."
As a Sims player, Lucy is typical in her devotion and also in her gender. Gaming's holy grail, according to Will Wright, is attracting female users. The Sims not only has family life, relationship maintenance, and home decoration at its core, but women are also attracted to its gender equity. A female Sim who opts for the military career path can become a 4-star general as easily as a man can. Lucy plays fewer than 5 hours a week, but spends up to 20 hours each week in online chat groups. One such site is mallofthesims.com, where Marty Meyer-Dierks serves as discussion leader, dispensing tips and tricks, such as how to amass a small fortune through the use of secret codes.
"Type in Control, Shift, and C, and a little box pops up, and you type in the word Rosebud and hit enter, and you get 1,000 simoleons, which are what the Sim money is called."
Money's important to the Sims because there is a direct connection between the things they buy and an increase in happiness on each character's mood meter. Marty walked me through a home in his Sims neighborhood.
"And I see this house isn't very well lit. All Sims like a lot of light, so we'd want to put more lights in there."
Now, they like lights, but you could still spend a lot of money on lights or a little money on lights. And a lot of it is decoration. Do they like more decorative lights? Will that affect their score, or does that just make you happy as the guy who's decorating the house?
"All the Sims themselves care about are what it costs, what the value is of the item. They don't care what it looks like at all. So if something is more expensive, they're going to like it more."
I mean, this just forces you, if you want to maximize your Sim's happiness, into a kind of massive consumer overdrive. Just got to keep buying more and more for them.
Right, absolutely.
Can a Sim ever achieve true success or happiness without all this expensive stuff around him or her?
They can, but their mood would not be as good as if they had all the expensive stuff.
Materialism runs rampant in Simville. Yet, as high priest of Sim knowledge, Marty may be misinterpreting the word of God. Will Wright, who read up on Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which places self-actualization on a higher plateau than acquisition.
I mean, if you play the game long enough, you start to realize that every item you buy in the game actually has some failure state. It can, you know, break or get dirty, and it has maintenance costs. And so in some sense, if you play the game totally materialistically, at some point you realize that you're basically filling up your house with these time bombs. I mean, literal, you know, these things that eat up your time.
In other words, you can boost your mood meter by blowing 200 simoleons on a topiary llama, but only if it doesn't cost too much time and energy. If a Sim spends all his time in the garden, his family may go hungry, or his house can catch on fire. And as a result, the mood meter will dip into negative territory.
It's a combination kind of how you value your things and your relationships, but primarily The Sims is about how you value your time, because life in some sense is kind of a time management strategy game that we're all playing every minute.
Sim disciple Marty seems to have gotten the time management message, and it spends upwards of 30 uncompensated hours a week sharing it with fellow devotees. He, for instance, will tell you that a carefully plotted 12 hours between a Sim and his sweetheart can lead to matrimonial bliss.
When two Sims' relationship scores reaches a certain point when they're in love, then one can propose to the other, and then wedding just happens.
And is there like a key shortcut for proposal, like Control-Alt-P?
No, it comes up in the menus. Oh.
The next big development is The Sims Online, which will feature live interaction between players. For the first time, the feedback won't be entirely determined by Will Wright's programming parameters. It could result in anarchy. It could bring about a form of utopia Wright never imagined. In his world, you know your party is a dud when the mime shows up. He can't wait to see who shows up in a world he doesn't control. For On the Media, I'm Mike Pesca.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers with Sean Landis, engineered by Scott Strickland and Dylan Keefe, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Jim Colgan. Our webmaster is Valentine Amy Pearl.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large. Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Bidell Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science. Neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.